Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a T-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Coming up on this episode of White Line Question Time.
I mean, walking onto the set of Ocean's 8, which I'd been cast in 2 days before, and seeing, you know, Kate Blanchett and, you know, Sandra Bullock and Rihanna all coming up to you and saying, hi, hi, welcome, welcome. And you're just like, OK, I've got to just somehow get little Richard from Leicester out of my head and be this character. So those moments can be hair-raising.
The devotees calling themselves the Armitage Army set up their own website. I mean, you spark obsessive behaviour quite clearly.
I don't know why. When you don't believe in yourself and somebody looks at you and they do believe in you, you think, well, whether I believe it or not, they do, so I can't let them down. So when I do turn my hand to something or do have an idea, I cannot fail her. I have to see it through.
And welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest today is an actor and now author who at 53 is arguably the top of his game. Born in Leicester in 1971, he was tap dancing at four and made his stage debut at 11 in a school production of The Hobbit, which is sweetly ironic because as an adult, he would go on to star in the movie trilogy. Even more ironic is the fact that he stands at 6'3" and played the King of the Dwarves. At 14, he landed a grant that saw him board at a performing arts school in Coventry before joining a circus in Budapest when he was 17 to gain his equity card. After clowning around, he landed back in London's West End in big musicals like Cats, 42nd Street and Annie Get Your Gun, before taking formal training at Lambda, which led to 18 months with the Royal Shakespeare Company, touring Macbeth in Japan and America. And in the early noughties, he transferred to the small screen in shows like Cold Feet before his breakout role as John Thornton in the BBC's North and South. From there came his stint as a spy in Spooks, followed by a series of Netflix hits like Obsession and adaptations of Harlan Coben's novels The Stranger, Stay Close with Kush Jumbo, and most recently Fool Me Once with Michelle Keegan. He now lives between London and New York. And last year, after proving to be one of Audible's most downloaded narrators in the crime and thriller categories, he was asked by them to write his own Audible novel, which he did, and it's really good. It's a thriller called Geneva, which he's now working on turning into an on-screen production, all the while still juggling his day job with a lead role in the new ITV drama Red Eye alongside Leslie Sharp, which airs this month. So let's dial him in. It's the beautiful dulcet tones of Richard Armitage. How are you?
Wait, am I 53 and where's my wine? It's my question.
Are you 52?
I'm 53 in August, so give me. I've got a couple of months
left. I'm going to give you 52. I apologise.
I'm clawing them back.
Listen, I sit here as a 51-year-old woman, and I hear you. Okay.
It came quick. Thanks for that. That's a mouthful, isn't it? I didn't know half that stuff.
Did you not? Is it all true?
I've forgotten it. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Apart from the clown, the circus is true. I wasn't a clown. I was throwing hula hoops at skateboarders, but so close.
So that's less ridiculous.
Yeah, less ridiculous.
Thanks for qualifying that, Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's quite the life that you've lived. I mean, the lengths that you went to get your equity card are really quite admirable.
Yeah, I mean, I guess back in the day, you couldn't even go to auditions without an equity card because there was like a door that said equity members and non-equity members. And the non-equity members, you'd walk in and they'd go, thanks very much, get your train home. You had to fight quite hard to get one. And the circus was my way of getting one.
It's kind of brilliant, though.
Yeah, I mean, the smell of elephants in the accommodation that we were sleeping in, I remember kind of coming away from it going, right, well, I've done that. It can't get any lower.
It's a long way between there and, you know, an Olivier nomination for The Crucible. But you got there.
I couldn't make the ceremony. I was shooting Hannibal in Toronto, and I remember begging Brian Fuller. I was like, I've never been nominated for any awards before.
Please.
And, you know, this is a big one. And he said, we're shooting on that day. I couldn't go. So I was gutted. But really, really amazing. And I'm actually going to be trying to get back on stage beginning of next year. So, yeah, theatre was where my heart is and where I started.
It really was, wasn't it? I mean, and you came through the musical route. We've had quite a few actors on who've done the same as you, by the way. So Luke Evans being one who came in, all, you know, jazz hands, all singing, all dancing, and then wrote basically a begging letter to a casting director just saying, please, please take me seriously for a role. I beg you. And it was the role that changed everything for him.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I think it's maybe disappearing now in this country where there's a definite divide between the musical theatre people and the straight acting people. And there was never really a crossover. That's obviously changed. But my begging letter was I had to quit the business, go back to drama school, completely reinvent myself, and then go out to the agents and say, look, I'm not that actor that was in the musicals. This is a different Richard Armitage. Yeah, I had to try and do that. But it worked. You know, I loved the work I did in musical theatre, but I did get to a point where I looked at it and thought, this is not for me. It's not going to give me a long career and a future that I was hoping for.
Well, it's a bit like being a footballer, isn't it? You're kind of done in your mid-30s.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
So then came the RSC and an 18-month tour, which sounded pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that was coming out of drama school and first of all, Birmingham Rep, but then getting to the RSC, I thought, well, that was the only thing I wanted to do. And now I've done it. What do I do now? I did two winter seasons, actually. I did Macbeth with Harriet Walter and the late Anthony Sher, which we took to Tokyo for, I think, 9 weeks. And I remember going into the administrator's office and knocking on the door and saying, look, I'm a spear carrier. I've only got 9 lines. Are you sure you want to fly me all the way to Tokyo? And then like, well, look, we'll give you an understudy. And then it makes it more worth the while. But no, it was great. I loved working at the RSC. It was it's such an institution and so well respected. So it was a good starting point, really.
It really was. I mean, gosh, that is a long way to go for 9 lines to hold a spear.
That's exactly what I said.
And hey, listen, congratulations on Red Eye. It looks great. New to ITV. It's all set on a Red Eye flight between London and Beijing and the corridors of power within Whitehall, starring your good self and the brilliant Leslie Sharp.
Yeah, no, I play a doctor who's arrested when he lands at Heathrow Airport, accused of killing a Chinese national, and he's repatriated under the control of the brilliant Jing Lucy, who plays the detective, looking after him. And then on that return flight, people start to die and you realize that there's something else at play. It's a kind of espionage, high-octane thriller. And Leslie Sharp is like the head of MI5. I mean, she's just a powerhouse.
She's great, isn't she?
Yeah, amazing. I mean, that face on screen and the sort of gravity with which she sort of delivers the role. And it's a sort of return, in a way, for me, to that that territory where that Spooks inhabited, and yeah. I loved that show so much, and I miss it. And so reading Peter Dowling's script, I was like, this is great. This is so up my street, the kind of thing I would watch, not just
yeah.
be in.
And that's very rare, isn't it, that you get offered the kind of work that not only would you watch, but also want to appear in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of, it's an alchemy that you think, this whets my appetite. And it's very revealing, because there are a lot of, you know, very important pieces of work out there, and it's great to do. But when you know, those two things marry, where you think this is sort of entertaining thriller. It's the not just to watch, but also to write as well. It's the territory that I've moved into to write.
That is a remarkable story. I mean, I mean, our landscape of work and opportunity is ever changing, driven hugely by the way people consume the stuff that you make, I make. And never more so is that apparent than the way in which you've ended up becoming an author for Audible. You know, they've tested you, you're hugely popular, and they kind of tap you on the shoulder and go, fancy trying a book? But they wanted you to work with a ghoster, and you were like, absolutely not, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I guess it was an experiment on their part. I think they just looked at the kind of work I'd done as an actor and then said, you know, would you be interested in collaborating on a thriller? And I said, yeah, but I'm going to write it. They went, oh, nervous shit. They went, oh, no. Oh, no. So I had to sort of audition my writing in various stages of like delivering an outline, delivering some sample material, and then they were like, oh, we really like this, and we like your voice, and we like the sort of balance of research versus accessibility, and then I set to work, and I had no concept that I could even write something longer than a short essay, which is all I've ever done, really.
Yeah.
I've done a few proof of concept adaptations of other people's books, but that's just been 52 pages of a screenplay, so I didn't know if I could do it, which is part of the challenge, really, because I just thought, okay, I've said I'm going to do this. I am going to do this. So I took my time and went through it with a fine tooth comb and worked with a brilliant editor, actually, who I'm working with again on my second book, because I've got another one
you
now.
You have. It was so good. They've gone again. But I mean, like, listen, you know, it's not like you sat down and wrote a book about an actor. I mean, this is in no way autobiographical. This is a proper thriller. It's about a Nobel Prize winning neuroscientist called Sarah, who is slowly losing her memory, and it takes in big pharma, dementia, biotech, and then you narrate it alongside the equally brilliant Nicola Walker. I mean, like, punchy.
Punchy. And it's interesting, because they were suggesting Nicola, and I'm always very conscious of, like, don't just sort of put your hand up for your friends. You know, I wanted them to decide, really, but I was so thrilled when she said
so
she would do it. And I knew that she would just make the writing sound better. But she contacted me actually after recording, because we weren't around at the same time. She was up in Glasgow filming. And she said, you do realize you've written a scene that we played together in Spooks. And I'd forgotten it, just gone into my subconscious. But there's a scene in the book where the character is drugged. And I suddenly went, oh, my goodness. Yeah, I remember that scene. So hearing her read it was like, it was just a nice little Easter egg in there for me, for sure.
But having read so many brilliant books in this genre, you must have been more familiar than most authors with arcs, narratives, the way to deliver something, hooking one chapter into the next. I mean, there's just so much that you would have learned purely by sitting where you are now, reading endless books during the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and that for me was four Agatha Christie novels. So I always look at that and think that's a great place to start in terms of crime thriller. But yeah, I have read a lot of really, really brilliant writers, some of whose work I've actually optioned to develop into television shows. But I also working on long form television, from Spooks to all of the Harlan Coben shows, seeing how the team kind of craft, you know, the 6 to 8 episodes, the hooks at the end of each episode, the hooks for commercial breaks on television. It's like all the same structural things need to go into book writing. We're storytellers,
I mean,
however we do it.
Yeah. And I think in telly, it's hooking people over what used to be a break. That's fast disappearing. With books, it's making sure that you keep that person reading, even though they said they're only going to go to the end of this chapter and then they're going to go to bed.
It's exactly that. And also the, you know, reading Harlan's work, he just has the knack of making you go, oh, go on then, just one more, just
I
one
know.
More. You're 4 a.m. going, okay, I was going to put this down, but I just can't. And I think there's a real it's a challenge to try and work like that. But if you're you can kind of basically for Geneva, I imagined what the television show would be like or the feature film, and then I wrote it down. So I see in pictures, basically.
Yeah. But, you know, that's no bad thing. And obviously you are developing it now for the screen, so probably quite pertinent that you did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are things that I had to lose from the book because it was sort of weighing it down a bit that I might reintroduce when it comes to the TV show. But, yeah, I'm currently box setting loads of things because we're auditioning writers because we're looking for a screenwriter that will respond to the material and, you know, go down the same rabbit holes that I went down.
Isn't it interesting though to be doing this kind of work at this stage of your career and your life where fundamentally it's the same but very, very different? You're getting in on all parts of different processes that have always been around you, but now you're running them.
Yeah, I mean, you come in tentatively as a new actor, or you know, in the early years, and I was lucky to work with brilliant people early on in my career. People like Jane Featherston, Jane Tranter, Julie Gardner, Nicola Schindler. You'll notice all of them are senior female executives who are still dominating the business,
which is nice to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's. I guess it's.
Yeah, Jane Tranter, she's just done something extraordinary. Didn't she just do Succession?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she set up Bad Wolf, and she you know, they run studios now in Wales. So they've all kind of evolved throughout their careers. And then 20 years later, I come back into the room and I'm like, hi, nice to see you again. Remember me from Robin Hood? And then they're like, oh, God, you're different. You've been out into the world and collected a whole bunch of experience. And I'm working with them all again. And Lachlan McKinnon, who produced Spooks, you know, was the executive producer on Red Eye. So it's really nice to come back with these people and, have grown up a bit.
Yeah.
And have stuff to share with them. And so hopefully we've got a sort of reignited future. You know, I'm definitely going to try and work with Bad Wolf again. They've been amazing.
Yeah, she's doing some really, really phenomenal work, isn't she?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the Dark Materials trilogy was extraordinary. Yeah. Of course, they've all got Doctor Who, so it's like they're top of the game.
Exactly. As are you, though. I mean, did you ever imagine that at this stage in life, you would be so in demand and taking your pick of some really, really fantastic projects?
I would love how you place it like that. It never feels like that from the inside. I suppose you move the bar a little bit and then you get used to where it's set. I suppose I'm not somebody that can, first of all, afford to sort of coast ever. But also I've just got this imaginative hunger that can't rest. Mm. So when I'm not working, and sometimes as an actor, you're always waiting for permission to work, for someone to give you the opportunity to go to work. When that doesn't happen, I can't stop working. So writing and trying to produce things is a natural progression for me because it just keeps my overactive brain very busy.
Keeps you out of trouble.
It does.
Well, I've devised 3 questions for you, which I hope will enable us to explore some of your extraordinary life and time. So are you ready for me to jump into the first one?
Absolutely. There's a glass of wine with it. I'm still waiting for it. Are you going to pass it through the screen?
Yes. Yeah. I'm sending.
It's on its way. Thanks.
There's a courier on its way. I mean, what says it's the weekend like a glass of wine at 11:20 on a Friday morning?
Don't tempt me.
For my first question, I wanted to unravel a thread that is seemingly stitched through your life, and that's The Hobbit. I think The Lord of the Rings was a book that you loved as a teenager, so much so that you've said before that you cried when you finished it. And then your first stage production at school was The Hobbit. And then, of course, came Peter Jackson's trilogy of The Hobbit. So I just wondered if you could unpick that thread for me and where you were at your life in each of those moments and how one has gone on to inform the other. A storyline.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because some of my experiences in primary school were not great. And actually, that's weirdly becoming the subject of the second book. But some of the best experiences were teachers. There was an English teacher called Mrs. O'Leary who read The Hobbit to us. And I remember being absolutely transfixed by the story, her storytelling, her voice. She did all the characters. I wonder if my desire to sort of be transported began there. Because then when the opportunity came along for me to be in a production of it at the Alexandra Theatre in Birmingham, I mean, I was just running around in a chainmail elf costume running in circles, and there was a paper mache dragon. But again, I just was salivating over going into this world of Tolkien. Then obviously picked up Lord of the Rings, read it multiple times. When, so it had become a sort of favorite of mine, fantasy, and this idea of a you know, Middle Earth, this universe that I loved being part of. When the Lord of the Rings movies were first being talked about, the Peter Jackson ones, I remember calling my agent and saying, I don't suppose there's a role in this for me, is there? And he said, oh, darling, they're already filming. You've missed the boat. So I I thought, oh, gosh, I'm sort of a bit behind the times, really. But then The Hobbit came along, and I had exactly the same phone call, and he said, oh, Guillermo del Toro's doing it. It's already cast. I'm like, how do I keep missing this? And then by accident, that situation changed. So Guillermo del Toro was no longer directing the movie, and the casting net was reopened, and I got the call to go and audition. And Peter Jackson was doing, he was going to major cities across the globe on this sort of auditioning tour, and he was stopping in London. Did I want to come in and read for a dwarf?
You're 6'3", right?
And I'm sitting scratching my head going, so do I put shoes on my knees and walk in the door and pretend, do I stoop a little bit, pretend to be shorter? Ironically, on the day that I met him, I'd just done a scene in Spooks where I'd hurt my back in a stunt. So I'd taken a lot of painkillers, and I was sitting on my hands because my back was so sore. And I thought, well, I'm going to be probably an inch shorter just because of this situation. But I
don't know that 6'2" makes you better qualified to be a dwarf.
I need to lose
than 6'3".
I needed to, yeah. But I don't know. It sort of took a very long time for them to come to their decision. But I think sort of there was a strange alchemy at that moment. And then I walked onto the set as a 40-year-old and just got transported right back to when that English teacher had read me the book. And I just thought, okay, now I've got to pick up the mantle and run with this character. But all of this stuff that had come from my childhood, I tried to carry with me.
I mean, if you'd have told that slightly unhappy schoolboy that this was down the road for you, that at 40 years of age you'd walk onto a major Hollywood set with this as a piece of work to play out, I hope that he would have taken some comfort in those uncomfortable years of trying to figure out what happiness looked like.
Yeah, and I think he would have stood there with his jaw open going, what?
Yeah.
What? But weirdly, you think as a 40-year-old, I should have been, you know, extremely confident in myself. And I didn't unpack my suitcase for a few weeks because I thought I was going to be sent home. I thought they were going to change their minds and recast me and send me back to England. But it didn't work out like that. And
what were the discussions around your height, Richard? Because obviously that must have been like, apart from casting Stephen Merchant, they couldn't have really got anybody taller.
Well, they had Graham McTavish as well as Dwalin. The philosophy behind it was that Peter wanted kind of warriors and warrior-sized people, I suppose. Although I don't think size, he just was concerned about shrinking characters and didn't want them to look like small humans. So he actually made us bigger to make us smaller. So
yeah, that makes sense.
There was a whole philosophy, but he said, don't you worry about it. I'll do that bit.
And he did.
He
brought you down to size. What was it like making that big leap? Because obviously there's a big difference between calling your agent and going, hey, can I be seen for this? And then actually getting it. Because when you sign on for something like The Hobbit, I mean, you're signing up for like, what, 7 years of your life effectively?
In terms of shooting and then promoting the movies, yeah, it's quite a big commitment. But I suppose you get used to it quite slowly, because if they said you've got the job and then tomorrow you're on the plane, that has happened to me, where you get a job at the very last minute and you're filming the next day. It did take a number of months to sort of for the film to be greenlit, for all of that work to happen. So it slowly dawns on you. But you're still walking into Peter Jackson's universe all the way, you know, traveling to the other side of the planet.
New Zealand,
with a
right?
A lot of fuss. Yeah, New Zealand. And so I suppose I've always had a philosophy in my own mind of no matter what role I was playing, prepare as if it's the job of a lifetime and it's the one you've waited for. So even if it's one line in Casualty, it's like treat it with the same respect that you would the biggie. And I remember getting to New Zealand going, this is the biggie. It's never going to be bigger than this for me. But I suppose somewhere I knew, okay, I know what to do with this. I know how to carry myself and you know, how to respect the material and how to collaborate. So I was ready.
And you had, I mean, when you look back at some of the experiences across your life, even boarding school, so, you know, you went to boarding school because you won a scholarship. So you were, and then you've got the circus experience and then touring with the RSC. So by the time you get to New Zealand and you're living in this kind of world of film production, and I mean, it is, you are prepared in so many ways by all of those experiences that have gone before for life at the other end of the spectrum.
It's true. I mean, in a way, the analogy of the circus it remains today. I'm always kind of on a plane with my life in a suitcase, going to a whole new group of people that sometimes feels like first day of school. Sometimes you're leading the movie, so there's a huge responsibility on your shoulders to sort of make everybody else feel good and comfortable. Walking onto the set of Ocean's 8, which I'd been cast in 2 days before, and stepping into the set of the Met Gala and seeing, you know, Kate Blanchett and, you know, Sandra Bullock and Rihanna all coming up to you and saying, hi, welcome. And you're just like, okay, I've got to just somehow get little Richard from Leicester out of my head and be this character. So those moments can be hair-raising.
Of course you did Ocean's 8 with, 2 days' notice?
Yeah. I think I was up a mountain, and then I'd kind of skied down and gone home on a plane, and I was going to spend a couple of days with my parents, and this phone call came in on the journey, and I got to my parents and then said, I'm really sorry, I've got to turn around and get on another plane to go to America, but was learning the lines in my mum and dad's living room and then on the plane back. So yeah, it's exciting though. I'm the actor that never says no. Sometimes to my own detriment, but I very, very rarely say no.
I would never have gathered that from your list of credits. In fact, I view something when I go, oh, Richard Armitage is in it. That's like a seal of quality. That tells me there's a benchmark has been achieved already before I've invested in watching it. It's like, oh, that's good to go.
Well, thank you. I mean, I suppose I never say no to the big challenges that, you know, a couple of times. I mean, Obsession was one of them. You know, the producer came to me and said, this has frightened a lot of actors away from this material.
Which I can is like see a
red
why.
Rag. It's a red rag to a bull to me. I'm like, okay, I don't know why they're scared of it, but bring it on.
We should qualify why some actors might have been a little kind of reticent. It's a pretty dark storyline, and you spend a lot of time having a lot of sex.
Yes, and also the criteria was nudity parity with the female character, which I just thought, well, of course, why would it be different? So we were treated in exactly the same way in terms of what was going to be seen and how the camera was going to shoot it. But I put that aside because I it's like, that's just sounds bizarre, but I was like, that's just a different kind of costume.
Yeah.
You know, nudity is a kind of costume, and it's like, it's not my body. Whatever that is. But I focused on the material, the book, which I just thought was an amazing psychological profile of a good person that treads a terribly dark road.
Awful road. Awful.
A taboo, a really awful taboo. But
still upsets me thinking about it, Richard. You did that to your own son, you bastard.
I know. And we like him as a character, but the event, the thing that he does, which results in something so awful and tragic and fatal, it's unforgivable, but he also doesn't regret it. I mean, it's such a complicated book.
He doesn't regret it, and you can't believe it. I mean, I'm not going to give it all away. If you haven't watched it, go and watch it. But the final scenes, just when you think this man has lost everything, you go, and he's prepared to lose even more. My God.
I mean, so interesting that whole story came from the brain of a female author, Josephine Hart, who I you know, no one's ever able to consult with her because she's no longer here. But I did read something about her that I thought maybe something like this had happened to her in her life. And this book was her way of saying, how can I punish somebody for doing something so awful? Because it is the ultimate punishment that the character
receives.
Oh,
it really is. It's karma being a total bitch.
Yeah. on the main bench. There you go. That's what I meant to say.
There's a book in that somewhere, I'm sure.
There is.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This takes me really nicely to my second question for you. There's a theme of obsession. You seem to spark vigilant and in some quarters quite obsessive support from the people that enjoy working with you or enjoy your work. So, for example, Harlan loves working with you and you feature a lot in his work. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are this kind of army of fans who almost broke the BBC message boards when that was still a thing, who were fangirling over you to such a degree when you kind of strode onto the screen as John Thornton in North and South. One newspaper reported at the time, Richard, and I'll quote, quote, "The women of Middle England swooned at the sight of his strong but silent John Thornton. They began to behave out of character, logging on to BBC message boards to chatter excitedly about the wonders of RA, as they quickly dubbed him. In the end, the volume of chat was too great and the BBC closed down the North and South message board. But undaunted, the devotees, calling themselves the Armitage Army, set up their own website." I mean...
Who wrote that? That's brilliant.
The Independent.
They did set up their own website. I mean, it's, I think...
You spark obsessive behaviour quite clearly.
I don't know why. I mean, I think it was a bit of a surprise. It was a surprise to me, that show. The BBC had another period drama out at the time called He Knew He Was Right. And they put a lot of weight and publicity behind that production. And ours had, you know, a good helping of that. But that was the one they were championing. And I think it might have been a bit annoying to the BBC that the fans were kind of into ours more than they'd expected. So, because there was never going to be a DVD release. And then that happened. And,
yeah, I mean, this is like a long time ago, right? So we should there was no Twitter. There was no
Twitter, yeah.
No Facebook. Yeah. This was a bunch of very determined women who just wanted to all come together and talk about you. That was their thing, and just kind of praise you.
And it's 20 years ago since that production, so it's the 20th anniversary this year. So I'm guessing the 40s, they'll be in their 60s now.
Yeah.
But you know, they're all 40, aren't they?
It's important, isn't it, to have an Armitage Army, because stuff like that is really what does turn a casting director's head. Because they know that there's a groundswell. But I wondered who's turned your head in such a way, maybe not just in life, but in work as well. For example, I know when you sat down to write Geneva, you really had Sarah Gilbert front and center of your thinking. And for anybody that doesn't know who Sarah is, well, you explain who Sarah is.
So Sarah Gilbert headed up the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine program. During the pandemic, I just really got into her, and just, she was like the voice of reason in a sea of you know, misinformation. And I started to look into the life rights of you know, whether it would be interesting to tell her story. But I suspected she was somebody that just wasn't interested in public attention. Mm. And then when the story offer came in, I just thought, oh, I'll use a character like that who is, you know, extremely intelligent, has done her thing. She's gone into retirement. She wants to write her thesis. And then suddenly she's thrust back into the public eye. So, again, I think probably... I related to her in a way, because she would sit in interviews and just answer the question really honestly. And you could see she wasn't after headlines or sensation, and no, I related to her.
She wasn't people pleasing. She was just getting on with a very difficult job and telling us how it was from where she was sitting, which was, you know, and there's a handful of people in the world that were occupying those chairs at that time.
Yeah. And also not bigging up her own sort of achievements. And she'd achieved a lot, you know, she'd been working on Ebola, and she'd, you know, I learned so many things from watching her interviews about, you know, what vaccination is and all of that. But, you know, as a scientist, I just thought we need more people like her around.
You know, that's in so many ways, that's one of the sadnesses, really, I think, of the hangover of the pandemic, is that for a long time, we focused our attentions and admiration on the right people, the scientists, the game changers, the ones mm-hmm. that are going to get us out of this holy mess, right? And then suddenly, you know, 4 years on, we're all going, oh, Kim Kardashian's got some new underwear. And it's like, oh, no, come on. Let's get excited about Sarah Gilbert again. I love the fact that you fangirled for her.
Yeah, I mean, I did. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I mean, didn't we kind of go through this period of during the lockdown, we were all like, gosh, the world's changed and we're different and we're never going to take this for granted again. And sure enough, we, you know, we're back where we started, possibly even worse, because our attention span is so short, we just respond to sort of clickbait and headlines. And, you know, I try to fight that, to be honest.
So do I
don't spend a lot of time on social media, and I love reading a kind of profile piece or a sort of, same, you know, longer essays on something interesting.
So I love podcasts.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to have a 4-minute conversation with somebody. I want to spend an hour with them so I can really understand them.
Yeah.
And I don't just say that as somebody that makes a podcast, it's as somebody that consumes them. I think nuance and context are so important and so lost.
Yeah.
In this digital age. So,
I totally agree. And here we are.
And here we are. talking. Who else has had that kind of profound effect on you? You touched upon your English teacher reading Tolkien to you. Are there other characters across the course of your life that have turned your head?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there were a few teachers through my life. I would say Betty Patterson, who ran the Patterson college that I went to in Coventry, who was, she was kind of very, very strict, and all the parents were frightened of her, but she kind of believed in me. And this was when I was in sort of, I was in education, but it was a dance and drama school. So she believed in me and she championed me. And I think, you know, when you don't believe in yourself and somebody looks at you and they do believe in you, you think, well, okay, I, whether I believe it or not, they do. So I can't let them down. Mm. I mean, my mom, again, I'm going to use my mom. And I remember overhearing her once talking to a friend in the kitchen. And she said, you know, when Rich says he's going to do something, he really does it. And when I heard that, I didn't realize that about myself.
Aww.
But then after that, I thought, so when I do turn my hand to something or do have an idea, I cannot fail her. I have to see it through. Geneva's a perfect example. I could have bottled out a few times during the writing of that and said, I can't do it. But it's like, you've got to see it through to the very end. Mm-hmm. You know, the going to New Zealand and starting on The Hobbit, I could have turned in something which I thought I was capable of. But it's that understanding of, I've got to make this, I've got to give more than I think I'm, you know, more than 100% here. I've mm-hmm. got to every single second, don't waste it. That comes from, you know, that phrase by my mom.
Isn't that extraordinary, the power of that overheard conversation and how that's carried you through so many big moments in your life?
Yeah. And it's less to do with success and more to do with personal input and personal achievement. Even if it's something in a small way, which isn't going to garner any public attention. You know, if I'm doing some DIY at home, I'm like, you're going to finish this and it's going to be perfect by the end of it. You know, I've become that person.
How is your DIY?
It used to be all right, but I've moved on from them now. I get other people to do. Not great.
Well, you're straddling of two different lives, aren't you? One in England, one in America now.
Yeah.
I love the fact that you went to New York on your agent's advice because you thought it would be good for your career and it's got you no work whatsoever.
Well, I mean, it was that thing of come to LA, and I just thought I can't go to LA because I'll miss London too much. And so New York was a good place to settle.
Yes, great city.
I did do a play there back in 2016, which was amazing, but Broadway is hard work. I mean, it's so different to the West End, and I naturally gravitated back to British theatre and British content and British filming, to be honest, because ultimately I realized that, as if I were a casting director, I wouldn't be cast in a British actor that could do a good American accent. I'd be cast in an American. And I suppose I was looking more at what storytelling roots interest you. So my kind of on-screen work and on-stage work has been very much UK-based. If I'm writing and recording, I go and hang out in New York City.
So it's kind of where you go to lose your work self and just be yourself.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I always say I've got a two-bedroom apartment. One of the bedrooms is in New York and one of the bedrooms is in London. So, I mean, I've just got a little crash pad in each city, but it's great because I can step away from all of this and go and focus in a different way.
But that kind of living between places is something you've done from boarding school onwards, really. And it's something we just had Stephen Mangan on. He had exactly the same kind of experience as you, not so much with the performing arts school, but he went to boarding school, the only member of his family to do so. Mm-hmm. And you just have this, I don't know, it gives you an ability to kind of live out of a bag and straddle two worlds, but also just to melt and mold your way into different scenarios, different classes.
Yeah, you have to adapt very quickly. And actually I went to, I was a weekly boarder, but I went at 14. So effectively I moved out of my childhood bedroom at 14 and became very independent because of it, and of course you're in dormitories and you sort of, all your belongings are sort of tucked into a little space. So it gave me certainly a kind of discipline, a little bit like being in an army, because you can't inhabit much space. So when it came to touring and that kind of thing, I was never homesick. I was always very adaptable, and walking into a new group of people, although I was always terrified, I was able to adapt very quickly and just get to know people and sort of create a family. Because as actors, that's what we do a lot, is we make fast families very quickly, because you've got to get extremely close, Charlie Murphy and I were both of us butt naked on the first day of shooting. And it's like, you've got to have this personality that can adapt to that.
Yeah, that takes quite a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, hi, nice to meet you. How's your journey?
Great.
And brilliant.
Great. Let's get our clothes on. I know, there's no other profession.
I'm now going to pretend to have sex with you against a wall. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's not an unusual story. Sometimes you end up playing the very final scene of a movie on the first day that you meet somebody, and you have to make really fast transitions to feel like to create chemistry. So,
my third and final question for you, I hope, is one that tickles your fancy. Are you ready?
Yeah.
If you could walk a mile in someone else's shoes, mm-hmm. whose would they be and where would you go?
Oh, my goodness. I'm trying to... Should I go political on this?
Go when... Listen, you can be more than one... You can have more than one pair of shoes if you like, Richard.
Can I?
Yeah.
Oh, God, that's really tricky.
And it's a hard question, right? Because there's so many scenarios that you want to flip through.
Think of the things that sort of terrify me. That I can't do. I don't know the name of anybody, but I wouldn't mind walking or swimming in the shoes of a deep sea diver, because I'm terrified of water, and I'd love to experience that feeling of not being terrified of water.
of liking it
and being able to, or free diving. I watched that brilliant Annette Bening movie, Naiad, and I remembered thinking, I can't even imagine what it might be like to be Diana Nyad, that swimming from Mexico to the United States over that amount of time, like to love the water that much. I suppose I'd quite like to be that person, or Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman. Why Gary Oldman?
I've admired him. He's been like a bar for me in terms of setting the bar according to your idols, because throughout his career, I don't know anything about Gary Oldman's life as Gary Oldman. I only know his work. And when I watch him in a film or a television show, sometimes I don't even know it's him. And it's not till the credits roll that I'm like, that was Gary Oldman. And I just love him for that. And I think he's had this extraordinary long career of very commercial and, you know, less commercial projects. And so, yeah, I admire him a lot.
But you've kind of done that as well. I didn't know too much about you until I had to research you, which is quite unusual because I've seen a lot of what you're in. So very little is known about you and your personal life. And I'm guessing that's exactly how you like to keep it.
Yeah. I mean, I've always felt like I'd like the work to do the talking rather than
I get
me.
It.
And I think it's partly to do with wanting people to suspend belief while they're watching you, so that they're, I mean, of course, the fan base is very important because it's what keeps me employed. But I also want them to forget that it's me, because my completely immersive experiences in cinema or on television are when I don't even know who the actors are. And I get completely transported by them rather than watching a star turn. So I've always shied away from anything celebrity driven and have preferred to let the character and the work do the talking.
It's really hard, though, in this modern age, isn't it, when you're the leading man, to retain that. And
and it's expected of you in a way to I've had to break my rule a few times, and I'm doing it this weekend because I'm going to be sitting on a sofa with Jonathan Ross talking about the Oscars, which is very, very unusual for me.
You're going to be passing. So what made you decide to go and be Richard Armitage for a night?
Well, you know, it's an ITV show, and Red Eye is going to be an ITV show, and I just thought, I've got to, and I mean, it's a subject I'm interested in. I think it has been a brilliant year for film, so I'll go and try and share some of my.
Are you dreading it though?
A little bit, because I'm just frightened of saying something dumb, you know. Something idiotic or not knowing the answer to a question, because I always feel like I'm going to be tested.
Yeah, well, I guess because you're used to working off a script and being somebody else.
I love having other people's words to say.
I think it was a really good reference, actually, Gary Oldman, because now I'm thinking, yeah, I don't really know too much about Gary Oldman apart from his work, and that's kind. I tell you, who else does that really well is Ian Glen.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, again, an actor I worked with on Spooks. I think it was it Spooks. Yeah, yeah. You know his characters, you know his his stage persona, but you don't know. Well, I sort of know where he lives because we're friends.
Same. Yeah. I know where he lives, but and he's a friend
not
of mine.
Anybody.
But no, exactly. And I really respect that about him.
Yeah.
I think it's harder for women to pull off. Actually, I think that there is an expectation that we have to give over more.
Yes.
I don't know why that is.
Yeah. I mean, we've all got to adapt, haven't we? Because otherwise our audience are only really, the new audience is only going to know us through social media, really, because they're not picking up print newspapers, really.
Yeah. But there is a thing now where the moment you sit down and start work, watching something, you know, you're on a second screen Googling, like,
yes.
Who's that then?
Yeah.
Who's that? And I think that's become really quite normal behavior. I do it. And I'm looking? I don't want to know who this person is in their actual life.
You can't help yourself.
Yeah, you can't. What's wrong with us?
I remember when we were rehearsing The Crucible, Yael Farber kind of would shut the rehearsal room door, put paper on the window, and she said to everyone in the cast, don't talk about this work outside this room, because everyone will come with their opinions, and I don't want anything from the outside world affecting what we do in here or infecting. And I've sort of held on to that. I mean, it's really hard now to do a stage production without, you know, first day of rehearsal photos, and this is what we're doing with these chairs. And you have to sort of build your audience before they will hopefully go and buy a seat. But
of course.
I'm sort of against it a bit. I feel like it should be a surprise. I'm against filming concerts. I feel like it should be a surprise. But
standing there with your phones, you mean, or
it
a concert being filmed?
Nuts. It drives me nuts because I'm like, you're not really here. You're filming it to watch back later on when you'll look back and go, oh, that was great, that concert. But I don't remember it because I was busy filming it. Mm. It's like I don't even take my phone with me. I just want the experience, but that's because I'm old fashioned.
Hey, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Thank you so much. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you today. Keep up your extraordinary work, wherever that takes you, be it the page, the screen, our ears, maybe a podcast drama.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Thank you for all of the research you did as well. I learned a few things about myself.
Did you? Yeah. I had this brilliant experience once with Jennifer Saunders, right? I used to do a show for Radio 2. Gosh, I can't remember what it's called. Paper cuts, right? So I would walk somebody through their life via their headlines. and I'm interviewing Jennifer and I say to her, and then in 1984, you met the Queen. She went, sorry, I think your research is a bit off. I've never met the Queen. And I went, Jennifer, here's a picture of you with the Queen. She's like, shit. It's amazing what we all forget, is my point.
I love it. Yeah.
For more chat with other great and good names from the stage and screen, why not head over to our back catalogue, where you'll find episodes in there with Luke Evans, Hannah Waddingham, Alan Cumming, Mark Bonner, Jason Fleming, Stephen Mangan, Tracy Ann Oban. I mean, there's plenty there, all waiting for you to hit play. In the meantime, thank you so much, as always, for your company. I'll be back on your feeds on Tuesday with a little something from the cellar. Oh, before I go, one more thing. Remember, you can always find us on Instagram for all the latest about the show. We're at @whitewine_questiontime. And also, please hit the follow button on Spotify. It's really, really helpful in terms of us being able to find you. Thanks so much for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.